Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And I've been doing this now for years. We're coming up on 10 years soon, Chris.
Amazing.
And as a result of having done this for so long, I get to see guests multiple times and see how their businesses have evolved, to see what they're up to. And today I've got a three-time interviewee here on Mixergy. His name is Chris Guillebeau, a name I'm proud to not just know how to pronounce, but how to spell, because I've written your name so many times over the years.
That's awesome. Chris, I can spell your name and pronounce it as well, just for the record.
Because I changed it to an American name that anyone could spell. If I gave you my real last name, Kalili, which is what I was born under, you'd have trouble spelling it.
I should have done that too.
Kaliki, I used to get. Kalali, Kalili. So I changed it to Andrew Warner. Much, much easier to spell. Have you considered switching your name to Warner?
I feel like it's too late. You know, when I first met Seth Godin like 6 years ago, I don't know if I told you this story. I asked him for advice. I was like, Seth, what can I do better? And he's like, change your name. And I'm like, too late. You know, like I'm already like doing stuff. So.
Yeah, you are kind of stuck with that name. Yeah. But thankfully, there aren't a lot of people whose names are Chris, G-U-I, and then anything after that. So if anyone just types that into Google, shows up. All right. Plus, I also believe that spelling is going to be outdated in about 5-10 years. We're all going to be speaking to our devices. Our devices will be able to adjust and type. And anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about, though that is very cool technology. When I first had Chris on here, we talked about his business, which was blogging on a blog called The Art of Nonconformity. I was in awe of how well his design was, how much his mission was both open to a lot of different ideas, but also very clear. He knew his audience. They were travelers. They were people who were trying to get out of the 9-to-5, but not in like this dorky to get out of the 9-to-5 way, more like creatively express themselves. And they were drawn to Chris because he wanted to visit every country on the planet, which did you do? You got to see them all?
I did indeed. Yep.
Yeah. North Korea?
Yep. Everywhere.
Everywhere.
It was 35th birthday. Yeah, I finished it 3 years ago.
And I was also in awe of this business that he had, which was unconventionalguides.com, where he sold these. What I liked about it was it didn't feel like he was just slamming people with expensive products. It had really creative angles on their titles, on their design. Like the guide to building a business was called Empire Building Kit. I just dug that. And over the years, we've talked about his different books, and now his business has changed. For some reason, he's not focused on the guides, which I was in awe of, which did really well, which is why I interviewed him. He's now got something called Side Hustle School, which I want to find out about, and he's got a new book coming out. This guy keeps publishing books. Side Hustle, From Idea to Income in 27 Days. This is not the cover you guys are going to get if you're watching the video. I happen to get a lot of these, what are they called?
Galleys.
Which
yeah, special
is,
editions. You know, they'll be worth at least a quarter on eBay one day.
If they survive, what I've noticed is, as you could see, I beat up books a lot. I don't understand when people are delicate with their books, like they're going to save it for their grandkids. You read it. You got to get into it. And so you could see, I like mark That's it great. Up. I fold
And
pages.
Authors really like that. You know, I go to book signings and people come up with books like that and they're apologetic. They're like, I'm so sorry. Like, I'm like, no, you read my book. Like, that's amazing. That's the best thing you can do for an author.
I used to be the kind of person who would want to save it just in case I ran out. I'm an entrepreneur who always thinks I'm going to run out of money. So I thought, if I run out of money, at least I have a clean book I could sell. This is like the woman who had to sell her wedding ring, her engagement ring, just to survive. Right? And then I realized, no, it's much better to get the knowledge in my head than anyway. So Side Hustle School is Side Hustle is the book. Side Hustle School is the business. Chris, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
You know what I should say? My two sponsors are the company that will help you send out smart email. It's called ActiveCampaign. And the company that will help you sell more when you're doing one-on-one sales. It's called PipeDrive. I'll tell everyone more about those later. Chris, your whole thing started as a side hustle. Yep. eBay was the thing.
My whole life was a side hustle. You know, my whole life was a series of side hustles. And, you know, I always said that I kind of realized at a certain point I was unemployable, basically. So got to do something, essentially. And unlike a lot of your guests, like I never, you know, single-mindedly focused on one thing and built it to like, you know, huge 8 or 9 figure revenue or whatever. But I just kind of, you know, from age 19, I'm 39 now, 20 years of just kind of figuring things out, doing things that I was interested
in. Why side hustles all the time? Why not say, you know what, I'm going all in. I'm going to have one idea, live or die by this thing, but I'm going to focus on it 100% the way you focus on getting to every country in the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, fair enough. I mean, like you could essentially say that the quest to go to every country in the world wasn't 11-year focus, but I had to pay for that. So that's where the side hustles came in. And, you know, this year I am almost 100% focused on Side Hustle School, Side Hustle Book, this concept, this message, really going out after it. But I guess for me, you know, I've always been interested in a few different things, and I didn't want to just kind of pigeonhole myself. I wanted to be able to shift and do things I enjoyed and things I found meaningful. So that was where the Side Hustle kind of way came to be, before that term existed, before it was common for people to kind of start lifestyle businesses. For me, that's what worked.
I see how it works for you, and every one of these little projects has its own special sense to it. Like World Domination Summit, your event, I've talked a lot about how beautiful it is, how every detail is taken care of. But that's you. For most people, isn't a side hustle something that you do on the side? You don't care enough about it to actually let it grow, and you hope it becomes something. But without investing all that you have in it, will it really be something? If my wife was a side wife, will we really be as engaged as we are with each other? Will we be able to deal with the lows? Yeah.
Sure, sure. I mean, great question. I wouldn't suggest that your wife becomes a side wife. I would say, though, that for a lot of people, a side hustle is, it's not that they're not invested. It's not that they don't care about it or they don't believe in it. It's just something that complements the rest of their life. And maybe they actually do enjoy their day job or their main business or whatever they're focused on. But a side hustle is additional security. It gives you different kind of confidence. It's a different kind of creativity, perhaps. You know, I talked to a lot of people who like do one thing for their day job or their business because they are focused so much on that. But then they like to go home and do something a little bit different or build some other asset on the side. So I don't think it's that they don't care about it. I just think it's a different way of thinking.
I think if you're talking about a side hustle, something you kind of do on the side as like a hobby, I kind of get it. Have your hobby and maybe it develops into something. That's one approach that you talk about in your book, Side Hustle. The other approach seems to be just try it on the side and maybe it becomes something really big, which is what happened with you, Chris, right?
Sure, sure. And I mean, I try to feature stories of different people like on the show and the book who do create like six figure or beyond, you know, side hustles. And sometimes that's their intent. And sometimes it just, as you said, develops, you know. You don't necessarily know what's going to happen, but the idea is that you're not taking on a lot of risk. You're not going into debt. You're not walking away from a secure job or whatever your secure position is to do something that's unproven.
Your businesses, which is the one that became the biggest? Let's talk revenue, not biggest impact.
Yeah, sure. I mean, actually writing books is probably more than 50% of my income. Like writing
really?
And publishing
you,
books.
You make money from selling these books?
I know, it's crazy. It's
How
crazy.
How much money could there be in these books?
Multiple six figure a year. It's not millions of dollars or, you know,
but we're talking about like a couple hundred at least a year.
Yeah.
Because you have your following who, like me, just loves your writing, will read it. You can put out Andrew Warner's Suck type book. I'll read it because I like your style. I like your style because it's quick and you have a lot of freaking examples. It won't just be here's why I don't like it and you pontificating for 300 pages. It'll be here's 700 people who don't like Andrew and I'll tell you their stories.
That's funny. Well, I try to be helpful. I think that's a good point. I don't think I could just put out anything and then people would buy it. I mean, it'd be nice if you would, but I don't think most people would. And I think it's, you know, it's been successful because I am trying to feature, as you kind of point out, this barrage of case studies. And I'm trying to show stories of people like all over the world and different backgrounds who have done these things in different ways. Because if you just write from your own example, people think, oh, I can't relate to that guy. Or if you tell one person's story, they're like, well, good for her, but, you know, she had some advantage or I'm not her or whatever. So, you know, with the Side Hustle book, I'm trying to feature like, you know, dozens of stories of people have done this very specifically. $100 Startup, which we talked about before, you know, really specific about all these accidental entrepreneurs, about how they built their business, how much money they made, where their mistakes were, et cetera. So I think that's why it's successful, I think.
I think that should be a lesson for every author. I don't need you to pontificate for 300 pages. Some people could pull it off. Most people cannot. I'd much rather you show me some examples because the examples not only add credibility, but they teach me. They let me learn about the world outside of my own world. All right. I thought when I first met you, you had a great model. You were blogging on the art of nonconformity. And then you had this business where you were selling these guides. It was actually producing good money. You weren't selling them for a lot of money. I think it was what, like $50 or let me see.
Yeah, it was like $50 to $100, you know, and it was like middle price.
Maybe I could go to $250 up to $250.
That would be the highest, yeah.
The highest end, right? What happened to that business? Why aren't you focused on that?
Yeah, I think I'm not focused on it because I don't think other people are focused on it. And I don't just mean my business. I feel that model has shifted for a lot of people. And maybe some folks are still being successful with it. But I do think, you know, starting a few years ago, there was a great saturation in that space. And because it was a great business, more and more people got into it. And then the way that people engage with content began to change a lot as well. I mean, podcasting has been around for a long time, of course, but in the past few years, there's been this like renaissance with it. And so I feel like, you know, in a situation like this, for me specifically, I could continue to do the same thing I've done, and I could kind of beat my head against the wall, and I might be able to be a little bit successful at it just because I have a track record and like I can evolve. But I think it would be just like this slow and steady decline.
And what you were saying was what? The business was online education where you sell the guides. Would you call them guides or courses?
Yeah,
I
call them guides. And, you know, online education, I think, also changed a lot, too, with like platforms like Creative Live, like Udemy, Skillshare, et cetera. Like people are just learning in different ways. And so if you want to teach and share knowledge online, which I think, you know, you do and probably lots of your viewers mm-hmm. and listeners, I think you have to be receptive to how things are changing and always be thinking about the future, not just about the past. So that's
before
kind of
it was possible for someone who was a blogger, who had something mm-hmm. to teach on his own site. How did things change? What do you see today?
I think it's still possible, but I think it's definitely different and it's shifted. And so for me, you know, one thing I thought was like, it was like last year, last summer, I'm like, okay, I need to wake up and enter, you know, 2005. And I should start a podcast. And so for me, I wanted to do that. That's why I focused on that this year. And
I
knew there were.
But I want to get a little more specific. Yeah. When you say it's not working because the thing because shifted, are you seeing that people aren't buying as much anymore
Correct.
Online?
Yeah.
That's what you're
Correct.
Seeing.
Yeah, I think not buying as much and just not as – it's not only buying. I mean, that's ultimately what it's about is revenue for that kind of thing, but also just lack of interest and lack of kind of like I'm not impressed. You know, like what's different about this? Why should I care about this when I can get this information elsewhere perhaps?
You know, I see. And were you were starting to see it in your numbers. At your height, where yeah. were you? And then where were you when you started to notice a dip?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, it was also like a multiple six figures business. And
can you be more specific? It's been like a few years,
sure.
so maybe we're not going to be
sure.
revealing anything private. How at its height,
no,
how much
mind.
Revenue did it produce?
No, I'm happy to share all the numbers. So I think at its height, it was like $500,000 business, okay. which was great. It was mostly just me. Like I didn't have employees, and I had to pay royalties and different things. But that's what it was at. And then I think it was a pretty. I mean, it was definitely kind of a steady curve. I don't even remember what like last year might have been like 100 or something. So obviously that's quite a decline. Part of it is I wasn't developing new products. I mean, to be fair, like I also wasn't really actively investing in it much myself. But I guess the reason I was not actively investing in it was I sensed that things were changing. I need to do something different.
I see. You see, there's a difference between you and me that I will, and I need to learn to stop. I'll just beat my head against the wall. I will keep going. I've said this forever. I hated school. I had no value or little value out of going to college. But, you know, I started out on this educational path. I wasn't going to stop until I finished it. I have to get to the finish line. I'm using this bike training app called Zwift. There's like a special challenge where if you can ride for, I don't know how long, I don't even know how to describe it. But basically, it's like a year worth of riding. I'll get the glowing bike. I'm not going to stop until I get to that.
Even if I discover that
cycling is not that great for me anymore, I have to still do it.
You're incentivized. You know, in that case, you have a goal line. In that case, you have this clear destination. And I felt the same way with going to every country in the world. Sometimes I was tired of it. Sometimes there was a place I didn't want to go necessarily, but same kind of thing. Like I'm motivated because I see a finish line. With a business like that, it doesn't have necessarily like this predetermined, like here's where you reach, 26.2 miles, therefore you complete the race. I think, maybe if I was still motivated to it, I would do it, but I was also kind of shifting my own motivation as well. Like I had done it for a while. It was fun. But for me, I'm only successful when I'm doing things I'm really excited about. Like if I'm excited about something, I will give 110% to it.
Yes.
If I'm not, then it's kind of hard.
And that's the other difference too, that you're thinking about this as like part creative, part entrepreneur.
Yes.
That, right? That you could have said, you know what? I see this being the next Creative Live for like this type of product. I have to get to that level. A billion is my number whatever is twice as much as what I have today will always be my next goal. But that's not who you are. And you want to get excited about the next creative project.
Yeah. I mean, creativity is a big motivation for me. Like I love what I do. I work all the time because I enjoy it. So I have to set my own goals and my own matrix for it.
Yeah. And that's essentially your audience too, I noticed. You talk about in the book, The Side Hustle, that people need to describe who their ideal customer is. Take them mm-hmm. to virtual coffee, I think you say.
Right.
Right. That means like kind of sit down and imagine you're having coffee with your ideal customer. What would you talk to them about? Right.
Sure.
Who's your ideal? How do you describe them? Because I have a hard time describing to other people who it is.
Yeah. You know, for years, I've always focused much more on psychographics than demographics. And so I'm not necessarily, I don't care about how old they are. Like mm-hmm. my audience is pretty evenly divided, men and women, which makes me happy. It's much more like Art of Nonconformity. Go back to that. The psychographic was like people who are pro change, people who want something different out of life, people who like to travel, as you said, who want to start businesses, who want to be an artist or something that's a little bit outside the norm. And maybe they don't necessarily live in places like San Francisco or Portland. They live in places where they might feel a little isolated. And my goal is to like find those people and connect those people. That was my kind of, you know, ideal customer for that. With Side Hustle School, I don't mean to interrupt you. I'm much more focused on people who have day jobs and don't necessarily want to like become a quote unquote entrepreneur, but they feel like they're on the outside looking in at this entrepreneurial movement, and they feel like a lot of the resources that have been developed, you know, for them are actually not really good for them because they're encouraging them to quit their jobs and all that. So I'm really focused on people who have day jobs. Would love the idea of having a different source of income, but don't know how to do it, don't have a ton of time. And so I'm trying to create a process for them. So that's who I'm focused on now.
See, I don't relate to those people at all. I don't understand that. And
Not everyone's like you and me.
What? Yeah, I get it. Totally fine. Intellectually, I don't get why you wouldn't do everything and also kind of pretend you have to go to the bathroom on a date with your wife and go check your phone, you know? Like, how do you not do that? How do you not go that deep into it?
Listen, for years I had a similar perspective, you know, and then like I've traveled the world. I mean, I did meetups in all 50 states, you know, every country in the world, et cetera. I meet a lot of really interesting people, and I realize there actually are a lot of like interesting, fascinating people who are fulfilled, like living a meaningful life. But they don't necessarily think the way that you and I do. You know, I featured in the last book a firefighter, like the woman who was the first female firefighter in Mississauga, Ontario many years ago. And that was her mission. Like, so if you want to be a firefighter, obviously you can't be a freelance firefighter. Like you have to be part of an organization, you have to go through like a process. And so she's still changing the world. She's living the dream. Right. But she also wants a different source of income, et cetera. My mom worked for NASA, same kind of thing. Like you can't be an entrepreneurial, you know, aerospace engineer, or maybe you can, you know, if you're Elon Musk or something, but like most people are part of a company or an organization.
I don't know. I thought you had an example in your book, and you have so many that I don't even know how to find it. Probably. A guy who was a NASA engineer who, oh no, I know what it is. I'm about to interview someone who was a NASA engineer who said, why can I solve the spacesuit issue for them? They're buying my space. Sure, sure. They're using my spacesuits, but I can't sleep in a warm bed because the blanket's not warm enough or something. All right. Right. So apparently she could have, if she would have gotten this book.
I'll let her know that, you know, she's just about ready to retire, but she's got 1 year left. So I'll let her know, what to do with her final year.
Betting. Her riches will be made in betting. But what about this? I don't even have to hunt deep in your book. Page number one of the galleys here is, there's a story about a British guy who works in a construction company, who created a website with a series of fish tank reviews, included links to Amazon products.
Yep.
Yada, yada, yada. A few weeks later, a check arrived in the mail for $350. His partner couldn't believe that this was real money until he took her out to dinner with the proceeds. Are we promising people the idea that, hey, look, do what you love. Money will just come in. You don't even have to pay attention. You explicitly say he forgot that he even linked to Amazon, and then a check for $350 came in, and then $700 a month every month after that, right? Mm-hmm. Are we promising them too much if they're not fully focused? Can they really deliver this?
Sure. Well, it is a true story, first of all, and you know every story in the book is true. I would never promise that it's guaranteed. I would never promise that it's easy. Like I try really hard to not use that word easy. Like I can say simple. You know, I can say like, you know, anyone can do it. Anyone can start this kind of project. You got to work for it. Do you have to be fully focused? Do you have to be fully focused? How focused do you have to be to write a series of fish tank reviews, you know, and like put it up on a bad WordPress site and link to Amazon? And the greatest thing about that, yeah, he's not making like a huge amount of money, but years have gone by. This is like the punchline to the story. It's like years have gone by. He's done nothing else for that website. It's still bringing in $700 a month for him. I think that's pretty amazing. You know, it's allowed him to go on an additional vacation every year, you know, with his wife.
Is that feasible for a lot of people? Will people be able to read this book and say, you know what, I actually don't care about fish tanks, but I really do care about Apple Watch bands. I'm going to create a site for that and then expect that they're going to end up with $350 coming in and $700 every month?
You know, I never tell people to follow their passion. I tell them to, like, follow your skill and find the convergence between your passion and what other people are excited about as well. So, you know, nothing is guaranteed, like no book or no resource is like, if I watch this interview, I'm going to go make $1 billion or whatever. But yes, I do believe it's a replicable process. And, you know, on the show every day, like I do this, you know, 7 day a week podcast now, like every single day, I'm telling a story of somebody who's done that in different ways. And I'm telling their whole, it's kind of like what you do. Like I kind of get into their failures as well and their mistakes and like what was hard and what didn't work work. But usually, you know, in the end, it's like I tried a bunch of stuff and some things didn't work, but then I found this thing that did. And so I do think if people kind of stick with it, they will find something like that.
All right. And you do believe it's a replicable, I can't say that word, repeatable process. You actually explicitly say to people, hey, look, you know what? You can adjust this process a little bit, but frankly, don't adjust it so much that you get away from what I'm telling you. Use this. It'll work. All right. So I'm going to come back in a moment and ask you about this process. And we'll start out with where ideas come from. Mm-hmm. But first, I've got to tell people about ActiveCampaign. Do you know about ActiveCampaign?
Just a little bit. I'd actually like to know more.
You know what? The thing about ActiveCampaign was I thought I knew about them because they've been around for years. They used to send out these just plain emails, right? You could just send out a broadcast email using ActiveCampaign. But from what I understood about them, they didn't have any marketing intelligence. And when I say marketing intelligence, I mean when somebody buys, your email to them should not be, hey, we're now offering a 10% discount to anyone who buys. Your email should be smart enough to send out messages to everybody, but you should be able to exclude people based on what they did. Or start sending the messages based on something they did. So if someone's clicking over and over and over and still not buying, you might want to reach out to them and say, we're going to give you a 20% discount. And of course, once they buy, you stop pestering about buying, but you tag them as having bought and you start sending them emails to encourage them to use what they bought. That's basic marketing automation. If you want to get even more clever than that, ActiveCampaign will let you do that, like put tags on your site so that when people are touching specific parts of your site, you understand it, and then you could send them email based on what they've seen. So imagine somebody comes over to your site and over again, they're clicking on the what's a good example of something from your site, like Uber. We'll get into how you talk about Uber. So if they're clicking on Uber as an entry point, you might want to send them an email saying, hey, you know what, here's a way to start with Uber as a side hustle, but actually move on to starting your own business. And I want to tell you about the entrepreneur who did exactly that. And now he's got a thriving business, right? You want to notice what they're clicking on in their emails. You want to notice when they're buying. You want to notice what they're doing on your site. And you want to do all of that so that you could then send out email that targets what people have done, that changes based on what they've done. So that's the idea behind ActiveCampaign. If you're out there and you're using one of these, there's one specific software that keeps, screw it. Why am I going to be like traditional and not tell you the competitor's name? It's MailChimp. MailChimp is a nice company. They offer no marketing automation. People sign up for them right from the start because it's free. But you know what? You don't want to send out the same email to everyone. And it's nice that they advertise on NPR. It's nice that they're a really good company and successful. But if you're really serious about your marketing, you can't use a company like them. You can't use a company like AWeber. You have to find something that lets you talk intelligently to your audience based on what they've done, based on what they've told you about them. And there are lots of different programs that do this. Most of them are way too complicated. And so you don't use them, or you use them, but you can't pass it on to an assistant because your assistant can't figure out how you used it and you're stuck. ActiveCampaign gives you all that marketing automation. They make it really easy for you to use. And I've noticed something that they've added that they didn't have the first time that I was advertising them. Free trial. So I'm going to give you a special URL where you can go and try it for free. After you sign up, they'll even give you your second month for free. They're going to do two free one-on-ones with consultants who are going to help you actually use marketing automation intelligently. And if you happen to be with one of their competitors, they will migrate you over. Here's the URL. ActiveCampaign.com/Mixergy will give you all that. ActiveCampaign.com/Mixergy will give you all that. And if you have any problems with ActiveCampaign, if you think that what I've said, if what I've said doesn't end up becoming your experience with them, I want to know about it. Come to my office here, 201 Mission Street, 12th floor. Let me know in person or email me, andrew@mixergy.com. I will never talk about a sponsor that doesn't live up to what I promise. So go check them out and let me know if it doesn't work out. ActiveCampaign.com/Mixergy. Yeah, I got kind of worked up in the middle of that ad.
No, so you believe in it. It's good.
I do. You believe in it. It's kind of awkward that I invited you into the ad, but I didn't address you after the first question. It was good. I was like a fire breather on that one.
I didn't want to interrupt that. It's good. I totally agree about MailChimp. I mean, I think MailChimp is great for like the pizza parlor on the street that's going to have 300 people on their email list or whatever. Like, I think that's who they're designed to serve.
Right.
But I think, as you said, if you're serious about your business, you're probably going to need another solution. So it's good.
Yeah. And for some people, even in my audience, it's going to be okay. But frankly, when you're really ready to do some good on marketing, strong marketing, intelligent marketing, you got to do it. All right. The first step is figuring out an idea. Dude, this is one of the hardest things in the world to figure out an idea, right?
You think it is?
I do. I think that if you're on the right path as Andy Ratcliffe, the venture capitalist with Benchmark, said, even if you screw up management, the business will thrive, right? Mm-hmm. PayPal did not believe in email as a way of sending money back and forth. They did it as like a side thing. And it kept taking off and enveloping their bigger business, which was sending money using, what were those old Palm Pilots, right? How do you find that right idea that'll take off? What's your advice?
I've been surprised about this too, because what I see is there are two problems, like people trying to figure out their side hustle or probably any business venture. It's like one, you know, don't have an idea, not sure what makes a viable idea. And then number two, it's like, I have plenty of ideas, I'm just not sure how to make them happen. When I started this project in January, I really thought most people are going to be in that second group. Maybe it's because like my own bias. I'm like, I have lots of ideas. Like I just can't do all the stuff that I want to do. But I started doing these workshops and like around the country, and probably 7 out of 10 people were like, I need an idea, you know? So what I'm kind of shifting to focus on is like teaching the power of observation, which is essentially about like learning to spot valuable ideas and learning to look, you know, so it's like partly internal, partly external. The internal part is like, let's take an inventory of myself. It's not just like, what am I passionate about or what are my hobbies, you know? What are my skills? Like, what are all of my skills? Not just the skill that I got in college or what I did for my day job, but like, what do people ask me about? Like, what am I like a so-called authority on? What's that weird little thing that I like to do? I'm really into fish. Like I have, so I know a lot about fish tanks. A lot of people need to buy a fish tank. What do? They go to Google and like fish tank review. Like that's the first thing they type in for that. If you're going to buy a fish tank or you know, wristband or whatever you said. So anyway, kind of going down that path is the first thing, like internal. And then external is just like spotting problems, you know, in the marketplace or something that bothers you or could be done better or more efficiently. Here's a story from the book of a woman who actually works in marketing, and she started this personalized candy heart business. Like the Valentine's Day things that say like be mine or whatever. She wanted to make them for companies like as a client gift and couldn't find a good solution. Basically, like long story short, she ended up starting her own thing, and that actually became a more than $100,000 a year side hustle. It's seasonal, so she just does it like mostly around Valentine's Day. She still likes her job, so she does that. So that's an example of like I saw something that wasn't working well. I found a way to do it myself.
Yeah, you have a whole chapter here about how to find ideas, and you say, I want you to get ready to, and this is not your words, I'm paraphrasing. You want us to be aware of what are people doing and what do they need. So if we start to see as we're driving down the street a line of people waiting to get to a coffee shop, we want to know what are they trying to do really? What are they really trying to accomplish? Not just the facts of trying to get coffee, but what are they trying to accomplish? What do they need? And you give an example of a guy named Steven, who happened to be a web developer. He noticed a clear need, which at the time was that people in San Francisco did not know how long they were going to spend in traffic. There wasn't a traffic information built into Google Maps. And so he leveraged it to to serve an active market, which is San Francisco commuters. And I guess he created a website for them to see how traffic was doing every day.
He created an app. Like the first year of the iPhone, like when the App Store launched, basically. He created an app for that called Routsy, which maybe you or some other SF folks are familiar with, and it actually ended up doing really well. So yeah, he saw that, you know, he's a commuter. He's like struggling with getting data or information about how to make his commute easy. Ton of commuters in the Bay Area, of course, and traffic is a major issue. So like since he's a developer, he has that skill. Like he learns how to make an app. By his own admission, the first app was really crappy. Like it looked terrible, had like all these errors, et cetera, but he put it out anyway, right? And it ended up doing, you know, really well. I think the first month he made like $2,000, and he was like, oh my God, like, you know, didn't expect that at all. Like that was, the advertising was like an afterthought. Like he's like at the last minute, he's like, oh, I should like sign up for a little campaign that puts banners on my app or something. And then after that, he started paying much more attention to it. And now I forget what it's doing. I think it's something like, you know, $7,000 a month or more.
In the book, you left it off with $7,500 a month, but I imagine that's
got $500 more. Down. Great.
Sorry.
Go ahead. It's good.
No.
I was like 7,000, 7,500, something like that. He's doing well.
Yeah. I just wanted to show you, frankly, that I read the book, that I actually remember the small details. That's a problem with – I really like that I read my guests' books before they come on. What I noticed, though, is first of all, it helps me ask better questions and guide the guest to talk about what my audience is curious about most. But it also makes me into a bit of a know-it-all, and I find myself either saying the story on behalf of my guest or interrupting them with small, like little details that aren't that important. You said 7,000, I say 7,500. I have to show you in the audience that I read the book. I have to give value out of the fact that I spent time reading it.
You know, Andrew, it's probably better than the alternative, because sometimes like obviously there's like a big delay between like when I write the book and then when I'm like out promoting it and stuff. And so I do like these radio interviews, and like especially when the book first comes out, like it's not as fresh in my mind as it should be. So like, they're like, on page 276, what did you mean? And I'm like, I don't even remember what I said on page 276, you know? So this is better than that.
You know what? I'll even take that over people who say, so what's this book about? And you know that they didn't read it. And they come at it with this idea that, you know what? My audience didn't read it either. And
Yeah.
You do talk about
Mixer G is legit.
Sorry?
That's why Mixer G is legit.
That is why it's legit. It's also why it might kill me here. I needed so much time. Actually, it just needed an extra 5 minutes after the interview started, but I felt guilty for having pushed myself to get this done on time and then needed another 5 minutes.
I
demand a lot of myself. I have to be aware that what I'm demanding of myself is always going to be a little beyond what I could achieve, and I can't be upset with myself for not being there.
That's a good lesson. I need to absorb that myself because I struggle with that too. And then I kind of like beat myself up and like that whole thing. So.
You don't seem to. You seem like the most zen person I know. You do.
No, not at all.
How does it manifest itself in you?
Self-doubt, like negative talk, like just frustrated at myself, like a comparison to others, you know, obviously, which is a terrible thing. Like, you know, intellectually, it's not good to compare yourself to somebody.
Let's get real here. Who do you compare yourself to negatively that's like almost embarrassing for you to admit here?
I don't know anybody that's embarrassing to admit. You know, Gretchen Rubin's a good friend of mine. Like, my podcast is on her network. She does a fantastic job. She's sold like a ton of books, but yet she's also like on all the social media, all herself for the most part. She doesn't have like a team. She doesn't want a team. She's got like one person who works for her. She's also got a family. I don't quite know how she does everything that she does. You know, people probably say that about you. They say that about me. But like then like people like you and I, we also probably know people who are like, okay, I do a lot, but I feel like she or he or whoever does so much more. So yeah, that's one person. She's great.
The worst are when people do achieve a lot and they're so mellow because it's all just easy for them, you know?
No, hate that.
You know, I recently read a book, Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night, that showed me how I need to be aware of where I'm beating myself up too much for not hitting my vision of myself. Mm. It talks about why so many comedians revere Letterman. He really was a risk taker as a performer. He would go on daytime talk, which he got fired from, which is why he's not known for that. And he'd bring a television set out and show you his competitors to see what was on that was better. He had such rapport with his writers. He was actually dating really seriously his head writer, but such rapport with them that they would physically lock him out of his stage when the show was starting. So the announcer would call David Letterman and he was stuck and you could see him just being pissed at himself and at the world. And that was kind of funny, right? He threw things like down a building to watch them explode on the ground. Really daring, interesting person.
I'm going to go read this book.
It's a good book. It made me go back and watch old YouTube videos of him to see why he was such a good performer. But to me, I don't remember him as a great performer. I remember him as the guy who came in second to Jay Leno. And what I realized was, when he went to CBS after he didn't get the Tonight Show, he was competing against Jay Leno and he was actually winning. But he was constantly competing internally with who he thought he should be, constantly saying, well, I'm not what I want to be. I'm not where I want to be. And it used to be internal. And then at some point it came out. It started to be out more on his show. He started to feel more what he calls self-loathing. But to me, it feels more like comparing himself to his vision of where he wanted to be in the world. And you get it. That worked for him, right? Most people wanted to be on Johnny Carson. I'm going to go off for a little bit on this book. Sorry.
That's good. That's good.
I'm passionate about it. Wanted to be on Johnny Carson. They would spend years just trying to get a set on Johnny Carson. He got it pretty soon after he came to Los Angeles. But not only that, he got to be the guy who took over for Carson when Carson wasn't around. So this pushing himself to be something bigger than most people would ever dream they could be helped him. But then it started to work against him. He started to feel like, why didn't I get the Tonight Show? What's wrong with me and the way that I pursued the business part of show business? He started to say things like, I screwed up the Oscars. And this became a big turning point for him. And the author of the book, Jason Zinnemann, said, the Oscars actually, when he hosted the Oscars, he had the second biggest ratings of the night. He went back, Jason did, and looked to see the reviews of the Oscars. And the reviews of the Oscars for his performance were all great the next day. They were solid. But night after night, Letterman beat himself up for not doing a good job with the Oscars. I guess he had a vision of something else he could have been. And he just kept letting this bleed into a show until the audience bought into it. And the popular understanding of his performance on the Oscars was that he bombed. Right? Because he set that in motion and he did that over and over until he just couldn't even stand himself anymore. So the reason I bring that up is I have big visions of where I want to be. I can't allow where I am today in comparison to that to be a drag, to be like the thing that I talk about, which I have in my past
interesting,
interviews.
Interesting, yeah.
It's a turning point for me, I think, to have read that book.
I was wondering, I mean, the whole time you were telling that story, you kind of went back and forth between whether it was positive or negative. You know what I mean? You're like, and he was like, you know, so driven, and he did this, and this was really good, and blah, blah, blah. He was so committed to his cause because of that, and that helped him to be good. But then, like you said, then it kind of shifts. And so is it that it's healthy for a time and you can't let it, you know, it's healthy when it's internal, but it shouldn't be external?
I think it's healthy when you use it in a healthy way, but it can really be something that you get carried away with. I thought that the fact that I kept pushing myself to do a better job in my interviews in the early days of Mixergy meant that I could read a book within an hour so I could prepare to do a good job with a guest, mm-hmm. and be okay with the fact that maybe we don't get to 99% of what's in the book, but that's fine. Where I think it became a problem was I started to say, I want to be this big thing. I'm only a podcaster. Podcasting is too small compared to where I want to go. And I didn't seize it for the opportunity that it was, right? So I didn't recognize it. And I remember even having guys like Tim Ferriss on, go, Tim Ferriss sees the fact that I'm interviewing him. Like, this is a little thing for him. He's doing bigger things than this. Podcasting is so small in comparison. And I let that become a distraction. Meanwhile, Tim saw this and loved what he was doing. Soon after he started podcasting, he came and asked me about what I was doing and how I was doing as a podcaster. The fact that he even got into podcasting is an example of how warped my vision was. Mm-hmm. So I can't allow that to happen. I can't allow myself to do to myself what Letterman did to himself later in his career. Mm-hmm. And as a result of it, not only did he lose to Jay Leno, but he had a kind of miserable life later on, constantly full of anxiety and self-loathing. And I wonder if he was even on medication. I don't remember whether he was or not. So it doesn't sound like that's an issue for you.
No, this sounds like it's very much an issue for me, Andrew. So if it doesn't sound like it's an issue, then I either just haven't been honest with you, which I don't think is the case. I think I've been pretty open and transparent, or maybe we just haven't talked about it. So let's talk about it now.
Sure. When you deal
which
with
part?
It. What do you do when you deal with it? When you see Gretchen Rubin, she's got incredible fame. Do you just brush it off? Do you have a process for letting her go?
I don't know if she's the best example, because like I said, I love her and she's been very good to me. It's more, I don't know. I don't know if there's like a single person that I look to that is like that. It's more just like what I feel about my own potential, which maybe sounds kind of inflated, but like what I feel like, I don't know. It's just like, you know, like the last book didn't hit the way that I would have liked it to. And so then it's like I'm concerned about my stature or like my status in the industry. And like that's such a bullshit thing to care about, you know, but I do. And so it's like there's this ego thing and there's anxiety. And then I also get emails from people that are like, oh, like I read this thing and it changed my life. And I'm like, but I kind of gloss over it. And I'm like, oh, that's good. That's good. I go on, you know, like it's good. But then I have some kind of negative experience, even if it's just my own perception, kind of like the Oscars thing, you know, like I just hosted WDS World Domination Summit recently. And for the most part, I thought it was like, I thought it was pretty good. Like the team did a fantastic job. Like I felt like we were really, really solid. There may be like 2 points in the facilitation that I did that I walked away. I was like, did not get the thing across that I really wanted to get across. And that's of course like what I go away with. And I'm like, we had this like amazing experience, like thousands of people in town, like in the biggest theater, like putting on all this parties and stuff. And then I kind of think like, I forgot to say that thing that was really important for me to say, you know, and probably nobody else cares, but I do. And so maybe the thing is, I do think it's good to challenge yourself, just like you said, like use this as like fuel for, I don't know, fire or something, but not beat yourself up. So I don't know the difference between the positive side. Like you said, like it's good when you use it in a healthy way. Well, yeah, that makes sense. But how do I know when it's healthy and when it's not? I think that's my problem.
I think for me, it's what do I do with it? And what's the self-talk that comes as a result of it? So if it's something like, I'm not doing enough as a podcaster. First of all, I need to just make sure, is that true? Because often those things are just lies that I tell myself. And the other is, well, if I'm not, then what do I want to do with that? Do I want to obsess on it? Or is there something I could do as a result of that? Is there something I could do? Is it figuring out the better questions to ask, the better guests? What do I want? And unfortunately, I don't have enough time to sit and think about it. And I don't think we do a good job of thinking about this stuff on our own in isolation. Because if you and I were talking about it, I could actually realize what this negative talk is, question it together with you, and deal with it. So I recently signed up for an app that's like a therapy app, just so I could say, look, here's my process. I do really well when I do it on my own, but I don't do it on my own enough. I do really well when I do it with my wife, but we have 2 kids now. We don't have enough time. Will you work through this with me? And just like, let's go through this process. And this app just stinks. These people are so – Talkspace. They're so bad at just introducing – all they have to do is matchmake. Just connect you with someone. All right. It's too bad.
So somebody needs to make that app, make a better version of that is what you're saying.
I do think so. I think that as a company, I get the sense that they don't care that much. If you go to their Glassdoor ratings, you could see that they don't care about their therapists. And I always thought, well, then their therapists will still care about the people. But when the infrastructure is not in place for the, when they don't care about their therapists, they don't set their therapists up for success with people. But I do think that model of like online coaching, online therapy, that kind of thing actually makes a lot of sense. Mm. All right. Back to your book, Side Hustle. So you come up with a bunch of different ideas, which is another issue, frankly, Chris. People do have a lot of ideas, and especially if you alert them to how to come up with new ideas, they're going to have way too many. And then you have this grid right here where you help them figure out which idea to pursue. Can you describe, like, what are we doing with this grid? How do you want people to come up with the right idea when they have too many?
Yep. This is a very simple process. It's meant to be intuitive. You can do it in 5 minutes. I call it the side hustle selector or something like that. The idea is like, you know, and you can do this for other ideas in life as well. Like, I've got 5 ideas. Okay, we'll write down my 5 ideas. You know I can't do all 5 right now. And then I'm going to come up with a set of criteria. And I forget exactly what criteria I used in that particular matrix, but you probably have it all memorized. You know, there's like 5 different things there, like profit potential, feasibility, something like that, urgency or timeliness.
Feasibility, persuasion, profit potential, efficiency, and motivation. And you want us to think on all those, in all 5 of those categories. Are we high, medium, or low? So is it high feasibility, medium feasibility, or maybe it's something I really can't do? Profit potential. Is there enough profit potential, medium profit potential, and so on? And what's interesting to me about your approach is you're not coming up with like a solid number for each of these ideas. You're not even coming up with something I could compare to like idea to idea. You're just saying be aware of these 5 categories. Mm-hmm. And once you are, and you could see where your idea stands with within each of those 5 categories, then you can pick an answer and understand like you're not trends, committing to this for life.
I feel like some trends will emerge as you do this. I think that's the important thing. And so, yes, if you want to assign a number, you could make it more complicated if you want to, but we're just looking for something simple. I think when you have 5 ideas, one good thing you can do is eliminate 2 of them, right? And so this might help you do that really quickly. Or it might help you see that there's like a front runner, or it might help you get down to the final 2 and then you make your choice. And that's why I include motivation as a factor, because I know a lot of business analysis wouldn't do this, but I think it's important in a side hustle or even really in your real business, but that's a different conversation. Like you should love what you do. You should be passionate about it. Even if you don't know about each point of it, like you should look forward to going home from work to working on this project. And so if your motivation is low, maybe that's not the right thing at this time. Like ideally you want more highs and mediums, you know, for all the categories. But, you know, we're each in different seasons in life. So sometimes you might need to make more money. So that profit potential is more important. You know, sometimes you're trying to just start your first project because you've never done this before. So feasibility, super important. You have to be able to see a path from like from here you are, where you are now, to like where you are 27 days later with this project started. So it's just it's a way to help you make decisions.
Let's talk about launching. Who's the right, how do we find the right people to launch to, and how do you want us to sell it?
I mean, there's all kinds of different ways to do that. I guess I've kind of gotten away from an extensive like pre-launch kind of model, like building like all this hype. And for me personally, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I've done it before, you know. I just feel like, speaking of saturation, speaking of fatigue, I feel that people are a little bit tired of that kind of stuff. Generally speaking. So you could, if you do it like amazingly, sure. If you do it in some different way, that's great. But otherwise, I think I'm much more focused on like, how can I make something that's really great? How can I find that group of people, even if it's a relatively small group of people at first, like kind of prove my model. And then from there, let's grow by referral. Let's grow by word of mouth, et cetera.
Sell like a Girl Scout. What does it mean to sell like a Girl Scout?
There's a story about this little girl who was 8 years old and set the record for selling the most Girl Scout cookies ever. I think it was like $80,000 or something. And, you know, she basically said, like, my secret was I went to people's doors and I asked them if they would buy, you know, $10,000 worth of Girl Scouts. And everybody said no. So then I said, okay, well, you buy 5 boxes. Everybody said yes, basically. So obviously that's like an old school sales strategy, but it's just funny when you hear about it from like a Girl Scout cookie selling, you know, perspective. And so my encouragement to people is like, be creative. Don't be afraid to be creative, and don't be afraid to ask for the sale.
Yeah, and you give examples of other people who are also doing things for nonprofits and for good causes, but instead of asking for the sale, they're a little bit pushy and they're trying to impose their desire on you.
Yeah, like walking down the street in Portland or other cities, like these people that stand on the corner and they're like, it's very aggressive about trying to get you to talk to them. And I hate that. I feel like it's manipulative, even if some of the causes that they represent are good causes. I feel like that strategy is manipulative.
Yeah, I didn't realize until recently that most of those people are just paid employees of some company that represents a nonprofit. I had some who worked here on my floor. They would do these rallies. They would talk about how to persuade people, how to stand in front of them. I didn't realize that that was a thing.
Yeah, it's guilt marketing. And I guess they justify it because, like, well, the end justifies the means or whatever. But I don't know. There's got to be a better way. So when somebody invents that better app, they have to invent a better way to do this too, maybe.
And I think it's one thing when you're getting paid to do that, but when it's your own product, I think not being clear about what you're selling and asking for the offer is a way of being embarrassed by the product and not actually getting the feedback, not telling people what you want. And so you don't get what you want and you don't get the feedback and it doesn't do well. Hey, let me do a second sponsorship message for a company called Pipedrive. Do you know Pipedrive?
Actually, I don't. I'm looking forward to hearing about it.
I freaking love Pipedrive. Here's the problem that most people have. You want to sell one-on-one to people. And so what you do is you fire up a CRM, you start adding contacts into there, and you start sending out email. And you can't keep track of where people are in your sales process. Who did I email yesterday? Well, do I follow up with them? And then after the follow-up, what happens? And worse than that, we start playing mind games on ourselves. We say, nobody loves me. Nobody wants to buy from me because I emailed everyone and no one responded. What Pipedrive does is says, you know what? I'm going to give you a set of columns, one column for each step of your sales process. So you do have to articulate what it is, and you could keep editing it and changing it and improving it as you learn, but come up with something. And whenever you send out an offer to somebody, put a card that represents their name in the leftmost column. And what that gives you is a visual representation of how many people you contacted. And they also give you stats. So you know, not nobody loves me, but you only sent out 3 offers yesterday. You only sent out 5 in the last month, and you think that you sent out a lot because it took a lot of willpower to do it, or it took you a lot of time to write the email, but you're actually very unproductive. You need to do more. Gives you stats. And then once you get your numbers up, like actually send out 10 offers a week, well, then the next step in your process is very clearly laid out. You look at a screen that shows you all steps. Each step has its own column, and you realize, I have a whole lot in the leftmost column. Nobody in the next column over. Let's start moving. So what do I do after that? Well, the left column over is send a follow-up email. Let's start sending follow-up emails to everyone. And I only get the right to move a card from the leftmost column to the next column to the right of that after I take that action, sending up the follow-up and so on. So you get to see exactly where everyone is. You get to see how well you're doing. We had a problem where we could not book enough guests and organize them in Mixergy. We fired up Pipedrive. Boom. Now I know exactly where everything is. I know how many people we're sending out offers to. I know where we're screwing up. Well, turns out for a long time, we weren't sending up follow-ups. So that's the idea. And then once you start hiring people to help you, they get to see your board and they get to help you out too. So if I don't send out a follow-up to Chris about, hey, would you come and do an interview with me? Andrea would see it and she can follow up because she knows what the next step is. All right. If you guys are out there and you're making sales, and this is for like one-on-one sales via email, via Facebook Messenger, via text, via phone, wherever it is, if you're doing one-on-one sales, you need a system to keep you organized, and Pipedrive is that system. I urge you to not just go to pipedrive.com/Mixergy, largely because I will not get credit for it. And I like getting credit for it because I'm competitive. I want to be their best source, and I have been their best source, even though they also are now advertising on NPR. I'm their best source of new customers as far as podcasts and performers go. But if you go to the special URL, you're going to get 14 days free, 25% off for the next 3 months after your 14 days free trial. And frankly, you'll get tagged as a Mixergy listener. And I know the company over there very well. I've interviewed the founder. I've gotten to know him and other people at the company. When you come in as a Mixergy person, they know that you are someone that they better take care of, largely because it'll hurt my friendship with them if they don't take care of my people. So here's the URL. Go check out pipedrive.com/Mixergy. That's pipedrive.com/Mixergy. I have a few other questions here to get into in the book. As you can see, I've circled stuff like 10 people to ask for help and so on. Is there something that you think is important that I should not leave out before I start getting carried away with my next set of questions?
I like your questions. Go for it.
All right. What about pricing? So now I know what I want to sell. I know that I'm going to be really clear with it. How do you charge, especially when you're charging for services?
Yeah. So this answer might be different from what some of your other guests might say. So again, I'm focusing on this like side hustle model. People get really overwhelmed with this. They really have no idea because they don't know how to do like a pricing analysis and all that kind of stuff. I would say first things first, when you're doing this for the first time, let's figure out what your baseline income should be. And so think about like how much you make for your day job, like if your salary, kind of break it down, like here's my hourly wage or whatever. For your side hustle, it should be no less than that, I would suggest. Like it ideally should be more, but like you want to make at least X dollars an hour or whatever. You kind of figure out like here's the service. How can I then, you know, price the service minimum, like it could be higher, but minimum is like whatever I need to see to succeed and call myself a success with this side hustle. That's what I encourage people to do.
Yeah. And I think what you're referring to is how many guests will say price based on how much money you're saving or making your customer, if it's a service or if it's a product, price on what competing products are selling for.
Sure. Maybe so a value-based
go
profit.
Cheaper than them or go way higher. Cheaper so that you compete on price, higher so you can compete on prestige. But you don't say that. You're saying, look, you guys are starting out. This is a side hustle. Think about your needs. What's the bare minimum that's going to make this useful for you? And then build on that.
Yeah, I do think that value-based pricing is a good approach. I think I always encourage people to think about, like, you know, what are people getting out of it, et cetera. So I think that's good. But when people are just starting out, like, how do I do this? That is kind of a hang-up. Like, I've seen people that had everything developed except the price. They just, like, feel paralyzed by it. And so that's why I'm just like, start with this. And then if it goes well, that's great. Then you raise your price.
You mentioned Lyft and Uber a lot. This idea of side hustle is a really good name. It's a great name for a book, great name for a movement, because it's a thing now, right? Everyone wants a side hustle, either because they're admiring entrepreneurs and they want to get into this entrepreneurship thing. Just like when we were kids, maybe we saw people wanted to, who are rock stars, and we wanted to play music and be rock stars too. Mm-hmm. It's entrepreneurs that are now those new rock stars. And so people want a side hustle for that, or because frankly, their job isn't paying enough money for them to live. And so they need a side hustle. And that's why companies like Uber are now capitalizing on it. I think Uber or Lyft has an ad right now that says, this is your side hustle. I was surprised when you kept referring to Uber, Lyft, and Fiverr. Why do you want people to do that? I kept wondering. And then I saw the difference between a starter idea and the next level idea. And this is a big part, I believe, of your approach. What is the starter idea and what's the next level idea?
Yes. No, I actually am kind of critical of, you know, the ride sharing movement or the gig economy as being a side hustle. I think those are kind of glorified part-time jobs.
Right. And not even glorified, because frankly, well, I mean, it may be glorified on the way in, but they're worse than part-time jobs in many ways, right?
Well, yeah, sure. So I guess it's just, I mean, you have the option to set your own schedule. So that is a major benefit, you know, but that's about it, right? Because everything else, it's no different from anything. So I think, you know, like I talked with a lot of Uber and Lyft drivers. I do think those folks tend to be more creative and more entrepreneurial than like the average taxi driver. And I think they are thinking about their future. They are kind of like trying to invest in themselves. So I think that's good. But I see that as like a starter idea. And so I make this distinction between, yes, you can go on Fiverr.com. If you've never done this before in your life, you can go on Fiverr.com. You can sell some kind of service and people are going to come and pay you for it like tomorrow or next week. They might not pay you very much money, but they're going to pay you for it. And actually, when you've never made any kind of money for yourself before, that actually feels really cool. It actually feels great. It's kind of like fun. Like I'm doing something for fun, like I would do online, except I happen to get paid for it. So great. But that's not really what I want to take people to. Like I want people to like, you know, get introduced to that if that's helpful. But then like my whole, you know, model with the side hustle is to help people create assets. And so if you're driving for Uber, you're not really creating an asset. You know, if you're helping other people drive for Uber, like this guy that we talked about, you know, briefly, there's this guy who built a business called the Rideshare Guy, and he's consulting and coaching other rideshare drivers. He's built like a membership site. Like that's a whole business. That's an asset because that's a growing industry. So that's a distinction I make there.
That's a really important one to make. I didn't pick up on that in the book, but you're right. I picked up on the fact that you want people to just start with something simple. And if it has to be an Uber thing on the side, that's fine. If it has to be a Fiverr gig, that's fine. But that's the thing that gets you thinking about side money, that opens up your eyes. Don't look at it as the way that you're going to pay the bills on an ongoing basis.
Exactly.
You know what I want to talk about that I don't think people are going to appreciate, but I think that's why I'm here. That if they can flip through the book and get the things that they think are important, I got to give them something that I think is important for them and they won't recognize. The origin story. The origin story is so important. How many entrepreneurs do I interview here who, when we pre-interview them about where the idea came from, they give me like an ABC thing? Well, first I just sat and made a list of things and then I came up with an idea and now I started.
Right.
What's the problem with that? Which is giving you the facts of here's ABC, the steps that I took.
It's just the facts. I mean, it's not that it's a problem. It's just very descriptive. It's very basic. It's generic. And so you can be basic. You can be generic. But isn't it so much more powerful, you know, to have a story like it wasn't just that I discovered this thing. It's like I had this huge problem in my life was it negatively, you know, it's not always like this, but this is just an example, right? Negatively impacted by this thing. And then I kept looking for solutions and I was disappointed. It's like I found this app and I was like, oh, this app is going to be my solution. But then I went and I was like, this app actually kind of sucks, you know? And then I found some website. I thought, but no, I was disappointed. And so then I'm like, maybe I can make it, you know? And then I'm not just making it for myself, but I realize there's all kinds of other people out there who also struggle with this. So like, oh, this is like much more of a community story. And then I found my first customer and like, it really did change their life. And I was like, I'm going to make this my mission. Like my mission in life for the next decade or the next however long is going to be to serve. Like, I feel like that's just so much more impactful and powerful.
Yeah. You give this example in the book about a couple that goes to Nepal. And as they're in Nepal, they get cold. And so they decide, you know what, let's get some warm clothes. They get warm clothes. It turns out the warm clothes are actually much cheaper than what you get at home and much more interesting than what you could get at home. And they start to wonder, can we bring this back to, I think they were from Canada. And they say, yeah. And so they bring back this stuff to Canada. And now this is an interesting story. It's got Nepal connected to it. We understand why they're doing this, as opposed to them just saying, hey, you know what, we wanted to make some extra money on the side, which is also true. And so we found this cheap stuff to sell in Canada.
So it's fine to say that, you know, but isn't it so much better to be like, oh, we actually met the mountain shepherds in Nepal who are making this stuff, and like, you know, a percentage of the profits actually goes to girls' education in Nepal, and we are excited about this as a company, but we're also excited about it as a mission. Like, isn't it better, you know?
And one of the reasons why I think it's important to talk about this and to have an origin story is people are going to ask you where the idea came from until the whole idea is gone, and then even afterwards. So you have this opportunity to actually promote yourself. Why not take it? And second, nobody connects with the facts. What they're asking for at that point is why? Why should I care? Right. What's exciting about this? Why do you care? And it's an opportunity for you to infuse some of your message. And I know most of us, when we're thinking about starting a business, don't connect with our message. We connect with the fact that I was trying to make some extra money on the side. Right. But we should think about why this way to make money on the side. How does this connect to who we were? How does this connect to one of our customers? And don't miss this incredible opportunity. And the other thing that I'd say is that don't, as having done these interviews now, over 1,000 of them, is don't lie. I know you think it's cute when you lie and you make something up because you think telling a story means like telling a lie, right? You're kind of treating people like kids. It always comes across as disingenuous, and it can be discovered at some point, and it ruins your whole origin story. Now your origin at the core is a lie, and it tells people something really damaging about your business. So just search inside yourself and find it. I wish that I could spend more time teaching people how to do it, but frankly, most people don't value it enough for me to spend time teaching it to them.
Interesting.
Here are two small things. I like to spend time on the big picture, but there are two small things that are important. Number one, you say, hey, you know what? You don't even need a website to get started. Number two, you say, frame your first dollar. So why not a website, and what would you have people do instead of a website?
Oh, well, I mean, I think a lot of people are going to want to have a website. I built websites, you know, that's normal. It's not hard to build your first website, et cetera. I just always try to think about objections, right? I always try to think about like, I can't do this because I don't know how to build a website. Well, you know, there are there's a number of people I feature on the show who have sold something on Etsy, and they start selling something on Etsy just, you know, kind of randomly, like Fiverr or whatever, but they actually end up building like a pretty successful, sustainable side business from it. So there's more than one way, I guess, is what I'm saying with that. And then the frame your first dollar, I'm encouraging people to celebrate their achievements and to celebrate their accomplishments, because, and this is something I struggle with too, I just kind of like always on to the next thing. But because I know how empowering this is, like I get emails all the time of like, you know, I made my first $150 and like I had to work 30 hours for it, you know, but I'm really excited about it. Like I really, like it changed my life, you know, et cetera. Just take that moment, just like the pizza parlor again, like you walk in there and there's like the framed dollar from their first sale or whatever that is for you, do something for that because it is important.
Yeah, not just the pizza guy. Warren Buffett has his first dollar on his desk, and he shows it in tons of interviews. That I know that he has on his desk is his graduation diploma from Dale Carnegie and Associates. I know because when we worked for Dale Carnegie, they used to talk about it, and I'm, you know me, I like to go and check, are they real or not?
Yeah.
I saw a YouTube video. He has his Dale Carnegie certificate behind. And
that's great.
So it made me prouder to work for Dale Carnegie when I saw that. You're talking about people who started their businesses on Etsy. I'm thinking about Mary Lynn Schroeder, who I interviewed, who sells journals now on her own website. It's called In Blue Handmade. But she did start just on Etsy. And I thought that what you were getting at with the start on Facebook thing was that there's a movement here. There's a change in the way the world works. Just like my dad would have thought of a store as the heart of your business or a factory. Mm-hmm. And maybe a website is a way to promote that. And then we told him, no, look, a website could be the place where the business is. It could actually exist here. I think there's a new shift in the world, and that is you could actually have a whole business that functions on one of these platforms. Yeah, it's a little risky, but it's not as risky as it was 5 years ago because they recognize the value of supporting people on their platforms, right?
Yep.
So their YouTube businesses.
Yep, exactly. And Instagram, people selling direct on Instagram, like building a whole business out of that, which really surprised me, but it's true. You know?
Me too, yeah. All right. Yeah. The book is called Side Hustle. It's coming out when?
September 19th.
Do you want me to publish this interview before September? I wonder if we could even publish it before September. Would you want it published before the publication of your book?
Like around that date would be good, but I want to accommodate whatever's best for you.
Okay. And if anyone wants to go see you in person, I see that you're around the country now. You're still doing these sessions. Where was that? Tell me about that.
At the time that we're recording this, I actually do not have my tour schedule up, but by the time people watch it, it will be up. I'm actually going to do a 100-city tour.
You are? And
yes. So I will probably be in your city. Like if you live in a major city, at least in North America, I'm going to start with that, about 40, 50 cities in North America. I will be there, and then eventually we'll go into international as well. So that should be on sidehustleschool.com/tour at some point soon.
And is this like a book signing thing? Are you going to be teaching something? What are you going to do there?
Yeah. So I try to keep it light and fun. I give a talk and then we do question and answer, but there's also like a chance to connect with other folks who are there. Just try to make it fun.
All right. I went to one of your tour dates.
That's right.
Before.
In DC.
I loved it. I like it because I like the audience that you bring in. You've got kind of a literate, educated, creative group of people around, which I enjoy spending time with, but they don't take themselves too seriously, which I also enjoy. All right. Sidehustleschool.com for all that. And don't forget, my two sponsors are the company that will actually help you organize your email properly so you send out intelligent marketing automation. It's called ActiveCampaign. Check them out at activecampaign.com/Mixergy. And if you want to do some sales one-on-one and not kid yourself about how many emails you're sending out, go check out Pipedrive, pipedrive.com/Mixergy. Chris, thanks so much for being here.
Andrew, thanks so much for having me again.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.